Hello and welcome to the latest in our Axial Spondyloarthritis podcast series. We'll be bringing you new episodes on a monthly basis alongside our RA and PSA podcasts, and we'll also be supplying you with monthly slide decks to help keep you up to date with the latest research and publications in the field of axial spondyloarthritis. I'm Hideto Kameda, Professor of Internal Medicine at Toho University. With me today is Dr. Sophia Ramiro, consultant rheumatologist and senior researcher at Riley University Medical Center and Zitterland Medical Center, and a visiting professor at the Nova Medical School in Lisbon. Also joining us this episode is Atu Deda, a professor of medicine and medical director of rheumatology clinics in the Division of Arthritis and Rheumatic Diseases at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. And of course, if you want to find out more about us and the papers we discussed today, please head over to the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum website, www.imidforum.com. Now, Sophia, over to you.
Thank you very much, Ito. So we will have the first paper today that we will discuss, in which the authors compared the retention rate of secukinumab over two different time periods. And in the second publication, investigators compared the improvement in sacroiliac joint symptoms following treatment with different DMARDs for axial SPA. So over to you, Atul, to start with the first paper.
Yeah, thank you, Sophia, and thank you, Hideto. Our first paper is titled Impact of the Time of Initiation and Line of Biologic Therapy on the Retention Rate of Secukinumab in Axial Spondyloarthritis. And these are data from the French Multicenter Retrospective FORCIA study. This is authored by Maxime Dougados and his colleagues. So the background of the study is that secukinumab was launched in France for the treatment of axial SPA in August of 2016. Prior real-world studies on the use of secukinumab to treat axial SPA in France were conducted shortly after its launch. And there is the possibility that data might differ if the analysis has been conducted at a different time, at the start or a little bit later after the launch. And this study compares the one-year retention rate of secukinumab between the patient that started the treatment shortly after the launch versus those who started at a later time period. And by that mean, they compared the 2 years immediately after the launch and then year three and year four after the launch. So it's a retrospective multicenter French study, including patients with axial SPA that initiated and received at least one dose of secukinumab and had at least 1 year of follow-up. The patients were divided into two cohorts, as I said earlier. Cohort one is patients who initiated secukinumab during August of 2016 and August of 2018. These were 906 patients. This was the first cohort of patients who started secukinumab immediately after secukinumab was launched, well, in the first 2 years after it was launched in France. Cohort two was patients who initiated secukinumab during September of 2018 to November of 2020. And these were 758 patients. And they compared the one-year retention rate between these two cohorts using the Kaplan-Meier log rank to look at the retention curves. Pre-selected factors for secukinumab retention at 1 year, these were baseline characteristics. They included disease characteristics, whether the patient had accompanying IBD, whether they had uveitis, peripheral joint involvement, what other treatments they were receiving, line of treatment. By that we mean first line or second line or third line. And time of secukinumab initiation, this was which year they actually started the secukinumab. And these were analyzed by univariate and multivariate Cox regression. And the results are that the patient characteristics were very similar across both cohorts, cohort one and cohort two. Higher number of prior biologic therapies were observed for cohort one versus cohort two. And I'll come to this point later in my discussion. And the one-year retention rate was higher in cohort two than cohort one. So the one-year retention rate was 64% for cohort two compared to 59% for cohort one. This is the main primary outcome, and this was statistically significant. In both cohorts, the line of biologic therapy, which means whether secukinumab was started as first line, second line, or third line and beyond, that was the single predictive factor for one-year retention. The retention was higher when secukinumab was used as a first line or second line, but not third line and further down. So the conclusion is cohort two, which started secukinumab treatment at a later date than cohort one, had a greater proportion of patients receiving secukinumab as a first or second line of therapy. Probably, I guess, because the rheumatologist in France, they had some familiarity with this drug and they were starting patients earlier. And that cohort, this cohort two, where it was started as a first line or second line, had a higher retention rate due to its use at an earlier stage of the disease than cohort one, suggesting change in the behavior of prescribing physicians. And the authors say that the real-world evaluations of a new drug should consider the date of its launch during the analysis. So before I ask both of you about your opinion, when I read this, I mean, I thought it was interesting. My one of the first criticisms after I read that, they said that the single predictive factor for one-year retention is whether the drug is started as a first or second line or third and fourth line kind of stuff. But despite that, the title of this study is retention rate impact of time of initiation and line of biologic therapy. So, and several times in the discussion, they say that time of initiation, in a sense, starting the drug later on after, so not immediately after it is launched, we should wait for a few years and then look at it. So that's not the real point. The point is line of biologic therapy. That's the important point here. And that's what they say. But then for some reason, they bring in this time of initiation. That's a very minor criticism, I guess. The point I wanted to raise was, why do we even look at retention rates? And I think this is a kind of a surrogate to look at the efficacy and safety of a drug. There are good measurements. There is ASDAS inactive disease, or there is ASDAS low disease activity, or whatever. There are several other things, partial remission. Those could be looked at to look for efficacy. However, in real life practice, those are not collected as one would do in a clinical trial. And so retention rate is a surrogate for looking at both efficacy and safety. If the patient is, the drug is not very efficacious, they're going to stop it. The drug is not very safe, people are going to stop it as well. Which also, by the way, there were more people who stopped the drug. Something like 75% of the time, secukinumab was stopped in both these cohorts because of lack of efficacy, and 25% for safety-related reasons. So it's a surrogate that we can use. This is the real world data, and FDA puts a very important sort of big emphasis on this real world data. And they want pharmaceutical companies to submit back these types of data to FDA. FDA wants them to see what is happening, because there are a large number of patients, real world experience, etc. And the last point I want to make is, this type of study is kind of impossible to do in the US because the retention rate depends upon patients' insurance, sadly, in my country here. If they lose insurance or they change insurance, then suddenly, you know, 1st of January, they get a letter, patients, and they say that, sorry, the drug that you were receiving last year is no more preferred, and now you have to change secukinumab to something else. Nothing to do with patient is liking the drug or not liking the drug or efficacy or not. And so these types of studies, I'm happy, can be done in France and maybe Netherlands and Portugal and et cetera, because of National Health Service. But so that was another reason I thought this was, I was very curious, and I was happy to see that these types of studies can be done. in Europe. So I will open the discussion. What are your thoughts, Sophia and Hideto?
Thank you very much, Atul, for this nice presentation of this paper and also for the starting this discussion. I share several of the ideas that you mentioned. And actually, I think it's never enough to emphasize that the line of treatment is very important. We're looking at the efficacy of a drug and we're seeing it again. And I say it because it's not that uncommon that we see analysis conducted of studies where the line of treatment is ignored. And here we see it again coming as an important factor of predicting response to treatment. I would like also to comment on your statement that this type of studies are conducted in European countries, for example, or countries that have a national health service. And indeed, I think you are right. If there's no national health service, I think this will not be possible. But I was also thinking that there are also, in essence, the persistence on a treatment is a very good measure combining efficacy and safety. I think assuming that if a patient is not responding, the patient will stop, or if a patient is developing adverse reactions, the patient will adverse events, the patient will stop. However, that is more a theoretical endpoint than in practice. You gave the extreme example of the US, I think we can say, where treatment can be stopped for external reasons. But I would say that even in countries with national health systems, there are more subtle factors that can influence, like the number of alternatives that are available for a given patient at a given moment, price fluctuations, because we also know that because of price differences, there is the advice or the recommendation of certain policies of certain hospitals to prefer for certain drugs at a certain moment, which can change throughout time. So I think this all type of more soft aspects can influence such an outcome that in the end becomes very difficult to take a real conclusion about what persistence means. And I think this paper is also emphasizing that. And as you mentioned.
I didn't know that, because in the entire paper, they don't say anything about price fluctuation, and I wasn't aware that these things can affect. So, because they should at least mention that in France, I mean, they should at least say that the price didn't change, or French government recommendations did not change. Because you're right, I mean, suppose in the middle of that, French Rheumatology Society came up with their treatment guidelines, I'm just making this up, and they say secukinumab cannot be first line or should be first line or one of that. That will change people's behavior, and that is very interesting. And at least there should be a comment, and I didn't see any such comment that in that 4 years that they looked at, there was no such external factor. But
perhaps it did not happen, but it's things to take into consideration. You mentioned now a very clear one, which is recommendations or international or even national recommendations, but also at the local level, even when hospitals within European countries follow or rheumatologists follow recommendations, at the local level, we see that the actual availability of drugs differs upon negotiations with pharmaceutical companies and their price. And those soft aspects that I'm mentioning can have impact, and they become very difficult to assess when we have such a large study. So I think it's good to also have that in mind, to understand that on the one hand, I don't have a better proposal in terms of an outcome that combines efficacy and safety and in real world, as you said. So it reflects it. But on the other hand, it can also reflect some external factors, and we have to be aware about that and to take that into account. And indeed, the time, so simply the fact that they found that the earlier cohort had a different persistence than the later cohort can also be a reflection of those different external factors that vary throughout time, and the way that rheumatologists look at certain treatments at certain moments can vary throughout time, and that is the evolution indeed. But it's tricky, and it's not possible to have an immediate solution. And I think it's sound to hear that results were found here and that are described are things we can identify from our daily clinical practice and that make that resonate to what we know. What do you think about it, Hideto?
Thank you. I agree with your opinions. And calendar data is very important because how many other treatment options do we have that may be different between cohort one and cohort two? And also, some guidelines or recommendation may be different between the calendar date. So all those factors will affect our treatment choice or some retention or changing or continues the first therapy or second therapy. So this data is very important and are very interesting. Thank you.
Yep. There is one quick, another point which I wanted to make, which I forgot, and that is it's the change in the behavior of not only the prescribing physicians, because they get a little bit more comfortable with this. But interestingly, they also found out that in the first cohort, where within the first 2 years the drug was prescribed, patients who discontinued, 21%, 20.5% of the patients discontinued because of intolerance. In the second cohort, that number drops to 16.4%. Slight drop. They haven't done any statistical analysis. But this also tells me that there is also change in the behavior of the patient, because new drug, people are always worried about whether this drug is going to cause me harm or not harm, or et cetera. And then after 2-3 years, and they, again, I don't know whether there are advertisements on the TV. We get bombarded in the US with direct to consumer advertisements on the TV. But patients and the doctors both get a little bit more comfortable with the new drug. And after 3-4 years, the intolerance also goes down. The nocebo effect also sort of goes down. So that was another small, interesting factor that came out in the study.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I think this is, again, emphasizes the importance of taking the calendar year into account to kind of adjust for different perceptions and different practices throughout time. Yes, so nice discussion, and maybe we can now have a good moment to move to the second paper, which is entitled Effects of Disease-Modifying Enteromatic Drugs on Sacroiliac MRI Score in Axial Spondyloarthritis, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis, authored by Hans Mennel et al. So as we know, sacroiliac bone marrow edema is an important factor in the diagnosis and in the management of axial SPA. And the Spondyloarthritis Research Consortium of Canada, the SPARC score, is one of the scoring systems that has been mostly used and that is used to measure the extent of sacroiliac bone marrow edema. Data on the effects of treatment on bone marrow edema, and so the SPARC, have not been summarized or had not been summarized, and that was exactly the aim of this systematic literature review and meta-analysis to assess the effect of different PD-MARTs and TSD-MARTs on the SPARC score, which was analyzed at weeks 12 to 16 as the primary endpoint and weeks 48 to 52 as a more long-term outcome. So a systematic literature review and meta-analysis was carried out on PubMed, including Medline and Cochrane Central. And studies were included if they were randomized control studies, which were evaluating the SIJ SPARC score at the time points that I mentioned, so weeks 12 to 16 or weeks 48 to 52, in patients with axial SPA meeting the ASAS criteria or the modified New York criteria. And in order to be included, studies had to evaluate the effect of the different treatments on the SPARC score of the SIJ in comparison to a control group. The outcome, or the primary outcome of this study, was any modification in the SIJ MRI SPARC score. And in total, 18 studies could be included. Six of them included patients with radiographic axial SPA, while 12 studies included patients with axial SPA in general. And if we look at treatment, four of the trials included JAK inhibitors, or were trials on JAK inhibitors, 11 on TNF inhibitors, and 3 on IL-17 inhibitors. and the MRI was evaluated, so at baseline and then at the primary, the timing of the primary endpoint between 12 and 16 weeks, depending on the trials, and in a longer term in 16 of the studies, so between 48 and 52 weeks in four of the studies. And so in two of the 18 studies, are evaluated both outcomes, the earlier outcome and the longer term outcome. And when the authors have looked at the results and have reported, they reported that at weeks 12 to 16, the SPARC score improved significantly with TNF inhibitors, with IL-17 inhibitors, and with JAK inhibitors. The comparisons are all against placebo because those were the trials that could be included because we do not have head-to-head studies that could be included. That means that it's quite tricky if we want to make comparisons across the interventions because the comparison was not made across the interventions, but from each of the drug class with placebo. And if we see that, for example, if we look at 10 TNF inhibitors, there was an improvement, a mean improvement in all studies of 3.3 points in the SPARC score, whereas with IL-17 inhibitors, 4.7 points, and with JAK inhibitors, 3.1 points. So when pulling all together, all drug classes, there was an improvement in the SPARC of 3.6 points. Again, without a clear comparison across the drug classes. Nevertheless, the authors, by looking at the different improvement of each of the drug classes compared to placebo, concluded that there was no significant difference between the treatment groups. So in conclusion, the authors state that there is a comparable improvement in each in the SPARC score of the SIJ in each of the drug classes at the 3 month after treatment. And the authors interpret that the results at 1 year, which show indeed an improvement in SPARC score, reflect a potential window of opportunity in the management of bone marrow edema. And they conclude that further explorations are needed to confirm the maintenance of MRI inflammation reductions and its correlation to clinical remission. And I think it's now good to open this paper for a discussion, and I share with you some thoughts about it. I think it's indeed important to see improvement of inflammation on MRI in actual SPA. I would say that a drug that has shown improvement on symptoms only without having shown to improve or to improve indeed the inflammation at the level of the SI joints, I think it has not yet shown to really act on where the disease is and where the complaints are. So I think it's essential to show this improvement. We indeed have that proof for all the drug classes that have shown to be efficacious in actual SPA and that are nowadays recommended. I think the thought of the authors that the improvement of bone marrow edema confirming that there is a window of opportunity is for me a little bit a step too far. I think that it can be raised as an hypothesis, but I don't think that this shows that there's a window of opportunity. It showed that there was a higher improvement in inflammation at the beginning of the treatment, but that doesn't mean that if we treat the patient later, so for example, if we treat the patient 3 years after the start of symptoms, it doesn't mean that we don't get the same improvement in inflammation when we treat the patient. So that means that, of course, we want to diagnose our patients as early as possible and treat them as early as possible, especially to help patients with their complaints. But I don't think at the moment we can say that there is real proof of a window of opportunity in actual SPA. This can be seen negatively, but it can also seen positively, which means if a patient comes to us in a later stage, we can still help the patient. We can still change the course of the disease and ensure that inflammation is diminished. So I think these are takeaways about this paper and my view on this hypothesis of the window of opportunity. I would like to hear your thoughts about it, Atul and Hideto. What do you think?
Yeah, so I completely agree. I think this we want to treat our patients with inflammatory, immune-mediated inflammatory diseases, axial SPA, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, whatever, early and aggressively. Because for every disease, the earlier you treat, patient gets better and we are preventing further damage. And this is true for any diseases that we see in rheumatology. But I also struggle with this idea of window of opportunity, because the window can be opened and closed. And when people say that, it kind of exactly what you said, Sophia, if that 1 year is passed, then is the window closed? I mean, no. I mean, there's always, the window is always open. You can treat the patient. It's one thing to say that treat the patient early and aggressively because you'll get better outcome. But then calling it window makes me a little bit uncomfortable, because people think that, oh, this patient came to me after 3 years, window of opportunity is gone. I mean, no, there's always window of opportunity. You can always make improvement to the patient. I mean, that was my first thought, and you actually verbalized it quite well. The second thought is there is a lot of interest, of course, about prevention of structural damage. But structural damage, you cannot really, well, you could see possibly with MRI, but that is looking at the T1 weighted image and et cetera, et cetera. X-ray changes take long time. And so we only have a single prospective study between IL-17 inhibitor and TNF inhibitor going prospectively over 2 years, showing that both of them actually work pretty well and reduce the radiographic progression. This is, to me, is like a surrogate. This is the earlier stages of looking at change in inflammation, because the idea is that if you control the inflammation very early, then hopefully you're kind of saying that all these agents, including JAK inhibitor, would probably reduce radiographic progression. And so from that point of view, I think this is a very interesting study. And of course, well, this was a meta-analysis, and I don't know why they didn't look at changes in the fat deposition and those kind of things, which they probably could have, but I guess they had a limited scope in their meta-analysis. But that would be also very interesting to know what is happening to the sort of surrogate marker for radiographic progression by looking at the T1 weighted images on the MRI and checking whether there are changes in structural damage, also prevention.
Yes, indeed. And I confirm that they only looked at inflammation. They did not look at structural lesions. But it's definitely a hot topic in the field and something we continuously look at, which are those are the surrogate markers for structural damage over the long term, and which are the best performing indeed.
One more quick thing is that what you said is again very true, is that just pain control, I mean, this is extraordinarily important from the patient's point of view. Pain control, stiffness control, all these kind of things, which is what patient comes to you for, basically, because they want to work. And they are not that interested in knowing whether the bone marrow edema in my sacroiliac joint is going down. However, by showing that the bone marrow edema is the organ of interest for in axial SPA. The organ of interest for us is SI joints first and then rest of the spine later. So to show that the drug is not only improving the patient-reported outcomes, extraordinarily important from the patient's point of view, and also for us, also working on the organ of interest by showing the bone marrow edema going down is, I think, extraordinarily important. Just like taking an extreme example, lupus nephritis, showing that the proteinuria is going down. The patient doesn't know how much proteinuria they have in lupus nephritis. Showing that that is going down and the active sediment is going down is kind of, you are indicating that the drug is really, really working on the organ of interest, which is kidney in that situation. So these are important studies to really do. And going slightly tangential here, there is this IL-23 inhibition in psoriatic spondylitis or AX-PSA. And there this question comes up that IL-23 inhibition helps with the PROs, BASDAI. But I mean, does it really working on the sacroiliac joint? Who knows? And that's why the study is being done, taking an example, of course, from psoriatic arthritis, to look at bone marrow edema in the sacroiliac joint and whether that really helps. If it does, then we would agree that IL-23 inhibition does really seem to be working on the organ of interest, i.e. the SI joints.
Yeah, indeed. I think what you just said, Atul, really emphasizes that we need both. Of course, we want a drug to act on patient symptoms, but we don't want it to act on symptoms without acting on the inflammation of the main source of interest or the starting point, as you mentioned. And the other way around, we don't want a drug to work on the inflammation without working on patient symptoms, but we really need both and we need to look at both of them. Totally agree with you. Hideto, any final comments?
Okay, so I'm very happy with these results. So seemingly comparable bone marrow edema reduction in TNF inhibitor, JAK inhibitor, and IL-17 inhibitors. But I want to know some difference among the mode of actions for backfill or erosion or something, because recent JAK inhibitor studies very closely investigate this effect of filgotinib or some JAK inhibitors on MRI findings, other than bone marrow edema. So I'm very interested in some differences between TNF and IL-17 or JAK inhibitor with whole MRI findings.
I think that's a very good point, Hideto. It has not been covered by this systematic literature review. We know indeed that there are data in the literature, data with, as you mentioned, filgotinib showing that erosions diminish with the filgotinib compared to placebo. Also, ankylosis diminishes. We also have similar data with the ixekizumab, both in radiographic actual SPA and non-radiographic actual SPA. And I think more data are being analyzed and will be presented at the EULAR. So I think it's, as I mentioned before, it's really a hot topic. So I think it's good for our listeners to stay tuned to this topic, and there will be undoubtedly more news about this on a short time.
Thank you. Okay, so thank you for joining us for this axial spondyloarthritis podcast brought to you by the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum. We really hope you find it useful. And if you did, please don't forget to subscribe to our channels on YouTube, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from so that you don't miss any future episodes. If you want to read more about what we've discussed today, head over to imedforum.com, where you'll find summary slides of both of the papers. See you next time.